We live on planet water. Just look at the Earth as seen from space. Yet only 2-3% of it is fresh and usable. This has been the field of study of Associate Professor Caroline Sullivan at the Southern Cross University in Lismore. And her domain is not only Australia, but would you believe, also Mongolia.
Well, in the study we did on Mongolia, we were very fortunate to be able to work with a student who was from Mongolia, and she was able to collect a lot of data from national sources there. So we were able to look at the country at a provincial scale, which was a much finer resolution than just looking at the country as a whole, obviously. And of course, it is quite variable because large areas of that country are very deserty. They're cold as well, and they're very different from other parts of the country, which can be quite forested, and obviously you have some urbanized areas as well. So there is a lot of variability across the country. And we learnt that in general, there was some parts of the country where rivers were functioning well and providing benefits for people, and agriculture was successful. But there were other areas where the situation wasn't as rosy, and in fact where there was a lot of pollution or there was a lot of soil degradation, and the harsh climate doesn't make that any easier.
And when you look at a place like where we are now in northern New South Wales, if you were to examine this area, which one assumes in certain times of the year is awash, has no problems, how can you tell the difference using your approach from what is the everyday common sense? Oh yes, you look outside and it's wet.
Well, we take into account a much broader range of issues, and we try to bring that human scale into it, because hydrological modelling is strictly based on physics and geography and water resource availability in aquifers and rivers and so on. Whereas what we try to do is say, look at the people. Where do the people live? What are they doing? How are they using water? What are the institutional arrangements about who controls the water? Because that can be a big factor, actually. And then looking also at things like what is the environmental impact of people's use of water. And taking those things into consideration makes a big difference. So an easy example to illustrate this is if we were to look at the United States, we would look at California, and if we were just using regular hydrological monitoring, we would say, California is a desert, we should never develop it. Now, of course, the proof is in the pudding, and people have developed it, and that's because they've arranged the finances, they've arranged the institutional structures needed to bring water to that desert. And that is what we need to do everywhere, really. Where are people living? We need to bring water to them. And one of the biggest problems in the question around water is the equity issue, because strong players, which may be commercial interests or political interests or even social interests, like in some countries, for example, caste. So in many parts of the world, in particular in Africa, you find that strong political groups or commercial groups, like large-scale commercial farming operations or big mining operations, they can have as much water as they like, even in dry countries like South Africa, for example. And yet ordinary communities and hundreds of thousands of people are left trying to struggle to get water from holes that they have to dig in the dry river basin. That, to me, is a serious issue that we need to address. We have to deal with it now before it becomes so political that it creates conflict, which it will.
As there has been on coal seam gas and fracking, what's your take on that particular enterprise?
Well, of course, we need energy. I think that we do need more science to show that the fracking activities do not have an impact on the important water resources in the aquifers, and it's particular groundwater that matters. And I think that no matter how optimistic we can be about our knowledge of science, our understanding of groundwater and its relation to surface water is very, very small. We can do maps and we can use some technology to try and show that there is groundwater there and so on. But we do not know what will happen if we break the rock and we allow that water to filter through in a way which hasn't been happening ever in the Earth's crust. I mean, I think it's a question of proceeding slowly with a precautionary principle.
But the exploitation of the resources will not proceed slowly. 2 years ago, in fact, when the Texan study was published that seemed to show that fracking was sort of okay and didn't necessarily disturb the water. I did ask the people who were doing the work whether the development was proceeding so fast it was leaving the science behind, and they said yes.
I think that's true. And I think for Australia, we are a water-stressed continent, and we are a major food producer in the world. And I think we have a responsibility to recognise that not every place can be a food producer. And there are a couple of places in Australia which are very important for food production because of their good soil. And this Northern Rivers area of New South Wales is one of those areas. We've got amongst the best soils in Australia. We've got more than adequate rainfall to produce masses of food here. And we need to think about that, because this is also the biggest growing area of the population of Australia, this and the southeast Queensland. So if we take the possible income generation and economic development that might happen from the exploitation of natural gas and coal seam gas, we would be able to benefit from that, of course. But it's such a small scale relative to the benefits we get from agriculture and tourism, which is also very important here. We need to think about that relative importance and the long duration, because the coal seam gas is only going to last about 20 years, whereas our agriculture and our tourism are there forever, hopefully.
Has your approach produced any surprises, and have you taken those surprises to the people who are in charge of development or running the landscape to tell them that they ought to have second thoughts about what they're doing?
Certainly through my students. I really like to make them realise the profile of the Australian economy, for example, because so many people think that mining is so important for this country because that's what we hear on the media all the time. But actually, if you look at the numbers of people employed and even the amount of money generated, mining is important, but not anything like as important as agriculture or even tourism. Tourism, I think, is such a neglected side of economies all over the world. I mean, tourism globally is bigger than the oil industry. So we should be putting tourism as a really important factor in our economy, especially when we have such wonderful natural resources to capitalize on.
What about climate change? Have you figured that into your calculations?
Yes, indeed. And in this climate vulnerability index that we applied in the case of Mongolia, it was very interesting because we could actually show which part of the country were going to be likely to be favourable in terms of the climate in the future compared to places that are favourable now. So, I mean, jokingly, I was suggesting to the student how when she went back home, she should think about investing in a house in one of those regions rather than in the currently favourable region, because the water resources are likely to change because of distributions of rainfall and changes in temperature, which in some parts of that country will be quite severe, actually.
Caroline Sullivan is Associate Professor of Environmental Economics and Policy at the Southern Cross University in Lismore, New South Wales.